Earth-like planets are very rare, and so they thought complex life is probably rare in the universe. But they didn't conclude design or purpose. They just thought, well, we're just lucky. All right, so the question is, okay, but if we're open to the evidence, would there be something, a kind of telling signal or a pattern that would lead us to suspect conspiracy rather than coincidence? Because that's what we're actually doing. We're really, really good at detecting the activities of an intelligent agent. Right? In fact, you can find like cave drawings, right? These are prehistoric cave drawings of people. Just a few little scratches is all it takes, and you can tell almost immediately, okay, that's a drawing. That's clearly a buffalo or something like that. So we're actually really good at detecting the activities of intelligent agents. But what happens is that when the possible candidate is divine, then people tend to sort of raise the standards for concluding it. But what, if we're rational, what we want to do is we want to say, okay, let's look at the evidence objectively and say, is it true that the natural world does, you know, just sort of seems to be all there is, or does it point beyond itself? We think that this telling pattern to discover the rare places where observers can exist also find themselves in the best places for observing, that's fishy. That suggests something. And so like I told you at the beginning, this is a cumulative case argument, which I have to give lots of examples of this. So remember, what I've given you is examples of the ingredients you need to build a habitable planet. And so remember, one of these was that you need to be in the right place around your host star. Remember that? You need to be in the circumstellar habitable zone of the Goldilocks zone. So that's one of the ingredients that's needed to build a habitable planet. And so the question is, does that also create a situation that makes our location better for doing science than those other less habitable places? So that Jupiter is not only a crummy place for life, it's also not a great place for doing science. That's the idea. And so these are the examples of what we call this correlation between life and discovery in the universe. And I'm just getting, these are just a list of them: the production of perfect eclipses, the layering processes on the Earth, plate tectonics, the transparency of the atmosphere, planetary neighbors, stars, galactic location, cosmic time, and a fine-tuned cosmos. So these are just some of the examples that we give in the book, of about 20. So these will be the three I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about perfect solar eclipses, the transparency of our atmosphere and a particular feature it has, and our location in the galaxy. Now, remember I told you all I can do is give you a few examples. So if I give you one example and you think, well, that doesn't totally persuade me, remember I'm just giving you an example of something that recurs throughout the evidence, or so we argue. That's why the book, incidentally, is 444 pages long, if you're wondering, as there's a lot of details there. So let's start with solar eclipses. This is actually how the idea for this argument started. So the production of a total eclipse. How many of you have seen a total eclipse? Not a partial, but a total eclipse. All right. Bunch of you. Good. So who saw the 2017 eclipse? And how many of you saw the one here just this year? Just a few of you, because it wasn't nearby, was it?
No.
So I saw both of those. It's, a lot of people think they've seen eclipses because they've seen a partial eclipse. But the difference between a partial eclipse and a total eclipse is the difference between night and day, if you've actually seen this, right? Because if there's even a little glimmer of the bright part of the sun, called the photosphere, the sky's bright. It just looks like, okay, there's like thin clouds or something, right? You wouldn't even know it if you weren't looking at the sun, which you wouldn't be. But have you ever thought about this kind of weirdness, right? That you get this perfect match in the sky between the sun and the moon. They're completely different bodies made of different elements, totally different sizes. The moon is 400 times smaller than the sun, but it's 400 times closer to the Earth than the sun is. And so we get this weird match. So what do you need to build a habitable, to build a total eclipse? So here are the basic ingredients you need to set this up. So you need a luminous body, in other words, a source of light, like the sun, and an eclipsing body, something to block the sun, like the moon. You need an observer platform, so some place where you can be, right, to see it. They need to be the right distances apart. And then they all need to line up in a straight line in space. All right, so here's a kind of simple diagram of total eclipses here. So you notice, so what's happening is that in a particular phase, the moon will pass in front of the sun, and you see there's this sort of dark shadow, and it comes almost to a point on the surface of the Earth when you're in the path of totality. If you're out of the path of totality, you just see a partial eclipse. But notice it almost comes to a point. And so that shows you that there's this really precise match, and as a result of this weird coincidence, we are able to see perfect solar eclipses in which you get this perfect match between these two bodies. All right. Now, have you ever thought about whether you could see perfect eclipses if you're on one of the other planets? Well, this is what, those are the kinds of ideas that astronomers think of. And that was the paper that Guillermo told me about in 1999. He decided to do research and to calculate what types of eclipses would be apparent from the other planets in the solar system. So there are basically 65 major moons, or a lot more than that, little minor moons, there's 65 major moons around the planets in the solar system. And so he literally did calculations to say, okay, would you get eclipses? If so, what are they like? And how frequently, and all those kinds of things. And so you can imagine the farther out you get, right, the smaller the sun is going to be from where you are. So if you're up floating on the cloud surface of Jupiter, the sun's going to look a lot smaller to you, right? And so if you have a moon, it's, you know, an eclipse, if you have one, is going to likely not be a perfect match. It's going to be much larger than the sun, right? So you're not going to get this kind of cool match. Well, these are the results. So it's a little bit hard to see, but so along here, along the vertical, so those are just the planets listed, right? And then don't worry so much about the details, but I want you to notice the little dotted vertical line in the middle. And you see it says 1.0, right? So what that means is if there's a line that crosses 1.0, that's what's called the angular size ratio of these things from a particular surface. So in other words, if it's at 1, that means that from your planet, you're going to get a perfect match between the sun and that moon. All right? Okay, so have a look. So here are the Galilean moons, so-called Galilean moons of Jupiter, Ganymede, Io, Callisto, and Europa. You got Titan and Prometheus, a bunch of other moons of Uranus, right? And so those little horizontal lines are all tell you either if they're on the left side of that, that means they're too small, and if they're on the right side, it means that the moon is so large that it completely engulfs the sun. So run your eye along. You see Earth. We have exactly one moon. Do you see where the Earth's moon is on that diagram?
Right in the middle.
Right through the middle. Right through the middle. Now, the reason that it's a line rather than a point is because the size of your moon does vary a little bit depending upon when the eclipse happens, certain times of year and things like that. In fact, the only other place in the solar system that gets anything like a perfect eclipse would be Prometheus. You see right there, there's a line that just barely overlaps the line, except that Prometheus is shaped like a potato. So it's not round, and it whips around, and so even if you were able to see it, it would be for like a half a second, and you'd have to be floating, of course, on the cloud surface, the top of the clouds of Saturn, because it doesn't have a regular surface. Did you get the idea? So the one place in the solar system where there are observers is the one place where you get a perfect solar eclipse. It's perfect in the sense that you get a match of these two things. Okay, now what does this have to do with anything? All right? Beyond the, wow, that's cool, right? That's sort of cool. And in fact, here one I found lots and lots of quotes of astronomers and scientists throughout the ages observing this and saying, this is really weird. It's just one of these weird coincidences, I guess, that we have this. And so they sort of knew intuitively this didn't seem likely to happen, but it wasn't until Guillermo did the study that we found that, in fact, in the solar system, at least, you're not getting these except the one place where there are astronomers to see them. All right, so remember I told you about various ingredients that you need to build a habitable planet. Remember, that circumstellar habitable zone, that place where you need your planet to be around your star. When you're in the right distance from your host star, so it's not too hot, not too cold, just the right distance, that's going to set your star as a certain size in the sky, right? So you're going to, if your good planet's going to be someplace where it could have liquid water, you're going to need to see a star of a certain size. In fact, you're going to need to see a star of about the size of the sun. All right, so that's the reason we see that the sun is a certain size, right? It's because we're on a habitable planet, and you got to be the right distance from your star for liquid water. So that's a feature of the circumstellar habitable zone. You remember I told you about another thing that's needed for a habitable planet? The moon. Remember I told you before the break? You need a large, well-placed moon to stabilize the tilt of the axis of your planet. And when you get that, that's going to fix the size of your moon in your sky. And when you get those two things, a habitable planet, guess what? It produces perfect solar eclipses. So the production of perfect solar eclipses is directly connected to two things that are absolutely crucial for having a habitable planet. Okay, now that's still not all. Because that, at that point, you're just saying, okay, that's cool that would sort of happen. But astronomers know, and people that know the history of science know, that perfect solar eclipses have been absolutely crucial in the history of scientific discovery. Perfect eclipses are like natural experiments set up to help us discover things that would otherwise be very difficult to discover. That's the connection. Remember I told you there's this connection between the needs for life, needs for building a habitable planet, and the needs for doing science. Let me give you just a couple of examples. In fact, I may just give you one. So these are three. There's the test of Einstein's general theory of relativity. Eclipses played a key role in that. They played a key role in helping us understand exactly what stars are made of, helped us discover helium, and has helped us to be able to actually measure the past history of Earth's rotation. Let me just give you one brief example. The test of general relativity. So Einstein's general theory is now it's the standard theory at large scales for understanding everything that happens in the universe at large scale. So the basic idea of general relativity is that rather than thinking of these bodies as sort of having attractive forces that pull each other, right? We still think that way. It's sort of gravity, the thing that pulls things together. Einstein said, no, that what you should really think about is things being related according to this thing called space-time, in which massive bodies, what mass does is it actually warps space-time, so that when you're near a large body or you're moving close to the speed of light, that's going to affect space and time simultaneously in some weird way. It's very hard to sort of conceive of this. You don't even need to. But Einstein made a prediction. He said, okay, if this is right, if massive bodies warp space, then if we were to look at starlight passing near the edge of the sun, a very massive body, and we knew where the stars were at another time of the year when the sun wasn't there, and then we mapped where those stars were when the sun is there, if his theory is right, the starlight passing near the edge of the sun will bend, and so it will look like the stars are in the wrong place. Now think about this for a minute. Because of the sort of basic predictions, to see the effect, it would have to pass near the edge of a very massive body like the sun, so right near the edge. So you're not going to notice the effect of the bending of space-time if the star is way out here away from the sun. It's going to have to be right near the edge. Now think about that experiment, right? Oh, I've got a way to test my theory. Let's just look at a starlight right near the edge of the sun. Most of the time, you can't do that experiment, right? Because you can't see the stars. But there's one condition in which you can do that experiment, during a perfect eclipse. And that's exactly what happened in 1919. Sir Arthur Eddington is one of two teams of astronomers that did this and confirmed Einstein's general relativity during a perfect eclipse, which has since subsequently been discovered. Now, I know that's a kind of arcane example, But I'm telling you, it's like one of the most important discoveries of the 20th century that makes it possible to do cosmology. And that would have been very hard to verify without perfect eclipse. So think of perfect eclipses. They're like, it's like a key that has made us, enabled us to unlock lots of mysteries of the universe, from the kind of large scale structure and the way things interact to even the stuff that stars are made of. All right, so that's one example. I'll give you another. I'm presupposing something here. All right, we can see the stars from the surface, or y'all can. I live in Washington, D.C., and we can't really see them there. But in principle, somewhere on the Earth, right, you can see stars. And of course, we take this for granted. That's, of course, a, you know, time-lapsed picture of the Milky Way from someplace high above sea level. But we can see these with the naked eye from the surface of the planet. But we take that for granted, don't we? But that didn't really have to be that way. You know, if you're on the surface of Venus, like I said, it's 900 degrees, so you're not going to be on the surface of the Venus. But if you were, you wouldn't see anything. If you're on Titan, which is the moon around Saturn that astronomers are interested in, completely murky and opaque. So you wouldn't even know, you wouldn't know what the sun is like, you wouldn't know that there are other planets. You just know basically nothing about the environment beyond the surface of your planet. But we have an atmosphere, nitrogen and oxygen rich, that's transparent to both radio waves and to visible light, which is the range of electromagnetic radiation that's probably the most informative. And so the atmosphere that life needs is also transparent to the electromagnetic radiation that tells us a lot of what we need to know about the universe around us. But you might think, well, yeah, but wouldn't it be better not to have an atmosphere at all? Yeah, well, in principle. Because, of course, if you had no atmosphere, like, if you, the only thing you wanted to do was to see, say, other galaxies, it'd be better if you were between galaxies in intergalactic space. But you'd maybe be slightly improving your view, and then you'd be excluding a million other things that you can discover if you're on a planet. And so the best place for doing science is going to be the kind of best compromise of all these different factors. Because it turns out that what you really want is you want an atmosphere that is generally transparent to light, but that also has water in it. Because it's only when you get that coincidence that you get rainbows. Now, it's interesting that rainbows show up in Genesis. There's no reference, it's a sort of symbol of God's covenant, which has since been used to symbolize something else, but it was originally a symbol of God's covenant. But it also turns out the production of rainbows have been really, really important for science. In fact, it's rainbows were a clue to probably the most important instrument, or one of the most important instruments that astronomers use, called the spectroscope. So a spectroscope, basically think of a spectroscope as a telescope plus a prism. So if you've ever wondered, how do astronomers know what the stars are made of? By the way, we're not sending probes to sun and like scooping up the sun to figure out its hydrogen and helium. Right? So you probably wondered, how do we know what it is? Well, it turns out that elements and compounds give off particular signatures in electromagnetic radiation. Think of it as like barcodes. And when you point a telescope with a prism at some object, and then you run the light through a prism and you reflect it, it's going to tell you, if you know how to decode it, what that thing is made of. There's going to be a hydrogen emission line. It'll also even tell you, you might have some black lines, it will tell you about the stuff that the lights pass through on the way there. And so with something as simple as a telescope and a prism, we can unlock what the rest of the universe is made of. But you know, we wouldn't have even known that that happened. We wouldn't have even known that white light split out in the different visible parts of the rainbow if it weren't for natural rainbows themselves. And you might think, yeah, well, big deal. Turns out it's actually really hard to get a rainbow. Now, I've given you the diagram here. And so basically, what do you need to form a rainbow? Again, you know, basically, you need light. Right? You need water droplets in the atmosphere simultaneously, and water droplets in particular, right? Because water droplets in the atmosphere are going to be a particular size, and it turns out they're just for splitting the white light of the sun in parts of the spectrum that form rainbows. And rainbows, as it turns out, were, again, a clue that unlocked many of the secrets of the universe. Transparent atmosphere, but not just transparent, transparent but also partly cloudy, because that gives us something we wouldn't otherwise have. I'm just going to pass all this. Third. The light and size atmosphere, because nitrogen, oxygen-rich atmosphere, which light is needed for life, also allows us to see the universe around us. Less light-friendly atmospheres, as it turns out, are much, much murkier. Now, all those examples I've given you so far have just been kind of had to do with our local environment here, right where the Earth is. So let's just blow all the way out. So I'm skipping about 12 examples to get out to the galactic scale, all right? So it turns out there is a galactic habitable zone. Just as there's a habitable zone around the sun, there's a zone around within the galaxy where you want to be for life. Now, Guillermo's not here, so I can brag on him. So Guillermo is one of the astronomers that that developed this idea. So he and Don Brownlee and Peter Ward actually had a cover story in 2001 in Scientific American about this idea of the galactic habitable zone. It's controversial then, it's now generally accepted by researchers. So what is the galactic habitable zone? So I think you guys mostly know, so that our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, is a spiral galaxy. So it's a flattened disk of gas and dust and stars, probably a massive black hole in the center of the galaxy, and then these spiral arms move, as you can sort of imagine, over time. So that's obviously not a picture, that's just sort of a diagram, but that's it's sort of what the Milky Way would look like from a distance. So then you say, okay, what would determine what a galactic habitable zone is? Well, the first thing is what's needed to build a habitable planet. And the second would be the survival, what's needed to for complex life to survive. All right, so here's a kind of schematic so you can see where we are. There's the galactic center. So the Milky Way is about 100,000 light years from edge to edge. So a radius would be 50,000 light years. So you see the galactic center. So these are the spiral arms. So there's the sun. And so we're between the Sagittarius and Perseus spiral arms, about 27,000 light years from the center to the edge of the galaxy. Now, Bill Nye, the science guy, says we're in just a sort of humdrum spot in the galaxy, which is just dumb. Dumb. unless you drum with respect to what? Would you like to be in the center of the galaxy with the giant black hole? No, that's the worst place to be. So if you want to have a planet with life on it, we're precisely where you would want to be. So like I said, so there's the kind of the trade-off when it comes to the galaxy. So in the center, you've got this black hole, it's perturbing lots of stars, gamma radiation, and X-ray radiation, stuff you don't want to be just in the proximity to, you know, very frequently. So this is the highly technical diagram that I have for you. Right? It's the center of the galaxy, don't want to be there. But the outer part of the galaxy, as you go from the center to the edge of the galaxy, the amount of heavy elements drops off. And so I think, you may not know this, the universe is mainly hydrogen and helium, and then trace elements, like that periodic table of the elements. It's mostly hydrogen and helium. In fact, astronomers simplify chemistry so that you don't have to keep remembering the periodic table. So they say hydrogen, helium, metals. Everything else is called metals in astronomy. It's all the heavy stuff, all right? And so as you get to the outer part of the galaxy, it's mostly just hydrogen and helium. There aren't any heavy there's not enough heavy stuff that you would need to actually build a planet like the Earth. And so what that means is you don't want to be too close to the center because of life-hostile activities, but you don't want to be too far out from the center because there aren't enough heavy elements. And so there's going to be a sweet spot in the middle, about midway out from the center to the edge of the galaxy, and between spiral arms, because there's things happening like supernova explosion going off in the spiral arms. That's where the Earth is. I mean, that's not surprising. We're in the galactic habitable zone, rotating at about the same speed as the spiral arms around the center of the galaxy. All right, now that's one part of the argument, right? That you need to be in a particular place in the galaxy if you're going to have life on your planet. But let's say you were to ask yourself another question. Where would you want to be if you were going to say, okay, I want to put a planet someplace with observers so that they are able to see distant stars? Maybe if they get on top of a mountain with a telescope, they can see and measure the distances to distant galaxies. They can detect the cosmic background radiation, a kind of leftover echo of an early history of the universe, so that they can actually see the structure of the galaxy that they're in well enough to figure out that they're actually in a galaxy, in a place where they can tell the difference between things that are nearby in space and things that are really far off. But you can only pick one place in the galaxy to be able to do all those kinds of things. Where do you think it is?
Billings, Montana.
Billings, Montana, baby. Absolutely. Or more generally, the galactic habitable zone. So, you see the basic idea? Right? This pervasive pattern that the things that life needs, the things that are needed for science, they end up overlapping. And now to make this argument work, we end up having to do lots and lots of comparisons in which we compare, okay, what's it like if you're on this planet and what can you see and what could you do compared to if you're on this planet or in this other part of the galaxy. So there's a whole lot of comparing going on. So, okay, how would this work to be able to see if it's actually better or worse? And over and over and over, when we look at the details, we find that overall, since you can only pick one place, right? The best overall place for doing science is going to be the place that's the kind of best compromise of all these different competing conditions for being able to read the universe and discover it. All right, so what? Well, there's about 7 different ways to technically make the argument for design from this. But you already kind of know it intuitively. You already made a design inference a little while ago when we did that coin flipping illustration, right? You're inferring design right now, listening to me. So you're not saying, well, it's possible that this could just be random sounds, like atmospheric sounds that are coming from that guy up there, right? And I'm going to calculate the probability of that versus this being an intelligent agent that's speaking. You're not doing that, are you? You're not doing complex calculation. You're able to tell that these sounds are coming from another agent, right? We do this really, really well. If you go to Black Hills in South Dakota, you see Mount Rushmore. Even if you don't know anything about Mount Rushmore, let's say you take someone that's, say, from North Korea and doesn't know anything about the U.S. history escape, and you take them right to Mount Rushmore. Are they going to do calculations and say, what's the probability that wind and erosion might have produced this? No, they're going to immediately infer design. But then the philosopher's question is, okay, so but what are the properties that when they're sort of happen, what are the things that cause us to detect design? Like, what do you need in order to say, oh, yeah, that's the result of design? Well, William Dembski, a colleague at Discovery Institute, wrote a seminal book called Design Inference, says usually when we infer design, it's a combination of 2 things. It's a combination of complexity or improbability, but not just that. Mm-hmm. It's something he called a specification or a meaningful pattern. So take Mount Rushmore. You might say, okay, so how do you know that those are sculpted? You might say, well, it just seems improbable. But there's a pile of rocks at the bottom that are also improbable. Any old pile of leaves is improbable. If you clean it up, you'd never be able to reconstruct it. But the pile of leaves doesn't have any kind of meaningful pattern to it, right? The faces, unlike that pile of rocks, conform very tightly to the human face. And any human's going to be able to tell that's sculpted. And anyone that knows the looks of the four presidents is going to be even more certain. So you see what we're doing? We're just doing it automatically, but we're seeing, okay, out in the world, I'm seeing a combination of something that's highly improbable and that has this meaningful pattern. And when those things go together, what Dembski calls specified complexity, we can reliably infer design. And so that's why I spent a bunch of time arguing, because in argument, you don't have to run the probabilities, but you need something like the rarity of the conditions for habitability and measurability in order to be able to kind of have a pattern that you can detect. And this is why, so for instance, the same way within a combination lock like this, so these, I get rid of these. I used to have these when I go to the gym. It's so hard, it's just much better to have the key, right? Because it's just very hard. There's so many possibilities, and they're very sensitive. But again, if somebody walks up in the gym and sees the lock and opens it, you know that they know the combination of that lock. Now, is it possible that by chance they could stumble upon it? Yeah, but if they get it on the first try, it's, right, you've got two hypotheses, happened by chance, or he knew the combination. You're always gonna go with he knows the combination, right? Well, this is the sort of same thing here, is that there's this, the correlation between habitability and measurability, or the correlation between life and discovery, it forms a meaningful pattern. And it's basically this. It's sort of the pattern of observers plus good conditions for observing. So imagine a mountain climber that doesn't know geography very well, and he's kidnapped by, you know, some agent in the deep state for some reason, let's say. And he's taken to an island, and he's dumped on this desert island. And the guy looks up and is like, well, that was weird, but there's this mountain. And he loves climbing mountains. He has no idea where he is. Turns out he's at the foot of Mauna Kea, the big island of Hawaii. And so he starts climbing this. And he eventually gets his way up. He crosses a road at one point. I think that's interesting. I didn't see that earlier. And then he gets to the top, and he discovers these telescope domes. These are the Keck observatories. Now, do you think he's going to say, well, why'd they put these all the way up here? This is an inconvenient place for putting telescopes. Why are these in downtown Los Angeles or something like that? No, of course not. He's going to know immediately, of course you put telescopes in good places for observing, right? He's in